Hey, before we get started this week, I want to tell you about a sponsor who is making today's show possible. That sponsor is Audible, the best place in the world to find audiobooks. They have 180,000 of them for you to choose from.
I have a hypothesis, Max, which is that our listeners are uniquely suited to the Audible environment because they're people who enjoy great writers, great writing, and they also like to listen to things.
In fact, they could listen to people they've heard on this show.
Like
on Audible.
Give me some examples.
I don't know. Michael Lewis.
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Liz Gilbert. They are all on Audible. In fact, many of them are reading their own books. If you like the sound of their voice on our show, you'd probably like them on Audible. Go to audiblepodcast.com/longform. That is audiblepodcast.com/longform. You get a 30-day free trial. Start listening to some books.
Here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey. Hello. What we got on the show?
Evan's lounging.
I am lounging. I'm sitting on the couch. We lost one of our chairs.
Yeah. You have to do all your interviews lying down now.
If you let it go, it'll come back to you.
I feel like it brings a certain relaxed sensibility that we don't always have.
Yes, well, it gets very intense in here.
Very intense. Who are you speaking to this week, Max?
I interviewed Kelly McEvers, who is one of the hosts of NPR's All Things Considered. And she's also the host of a new NPR podcast, which is called Embedded, which is great. And before that, before all that, Kelly was a war correspondent for NPR. And we talked about that time in her life as well, which is pretty crazy.
Our sponsor this week is MailChimp. They're simply the best way to send an email newsletter, which you need if you're doing just about anything these days.
And now here's Max with Kelly McEvers.
Hello, Kelly McEvers.
Hi there.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
I'm so excited to do this.
I have been looking forward to this, and I have a lot of things that I want to talk to you about, the stuff you're doing now, but in the interim between when we scheduled this and now, I got a piece of writing of yours in my inbox from Lenny.
Yeah.
You wrote this piece called How It Ends. And since this podcast is ostensibly about writing, I feel like we should start there.
Okay.
And I actually want to start where that piece starts, which is with the fixers you had when you were covering the Middle East for NPR. And I was kind of struck by how high up in this piece they are. Like, it's sort of the first place you go is talking about Ahmed in Baghdad and then your driver in Beirut and how close you were with them. I'm looking at it now and it says it was your first day on the job and you knew that you and Ahmed would die for each other. And so I was hoping maybe we could just start by you telling me a little bit more about that relationship and maybe why that's where this piece starts.
It's funny because I was driving a car. The piece starts, I'm driving a car in Los Angeles, which at the time felt like the most absurd place on earth. It's, of course, the place I live now, and it feels a little less absurd. It was September 2013 when I first moved back to the U.S. from the Middle East. So not only did Los Angeles seem really absurd, Ocean Park, Palms, like just these names, I just couldn't deal. Like, it was so nice all the time. It was so horrible. So many crazy, weird things about moving to LA, but like I'm driving all of a sudden again, and it made me think like, oh yeah, I just spent years of my life not driving myself anywhere. And of course I think about the guys, and it was all guys, who drove me places because I spent more time with them than anybody. And because they did everything. I mean, they're not like, there's not a single story that like went on the radio or got written that wasn't because of them. I mean, they're all of it. We call them fixers too. I mean, sometimes someone's driving you, but they're also arranging interviews for you.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds so practical. Like, it's just this person providing a service, you know, you get in his car and it's just like, it's everything in between.
Well, it also made me think about just reading that, like, the tremendous amount of trust that you have to put in that person immediately.
Exactly.
Like, day one,
yeah,
you are in a car in a country you don't know, which is at war, and like your life is quite literally in that person's hands.
It was that first day in Baghdad, and Ahmed, my dear, dear Ahmed was driving me around. He'd picked me up in the airport, and we were in our armored Toyota Hilux. And he was explaining to me, I was like, well, so what does it mean to be armored? And he's like, you know, he's basically explaining like how many hours you have if you're in the middle of a shootout before the armor on the car stops working. And so, like, he's describing this to me as we're just, like, driving around town.
This is, like, your ride from the airport.
Yeah. And I'm just looking at him, and I'm like, holy crap. That's your job. You're not just my taxi driver. Like, you're talking about a situation where we could be in some shit. And, I mean, I just immediately knew that, like, our relationship was going to be really intense. And I mean, God, but this, I'm like, I got there in 2010. Like, these guys had been through so much by the time I got there. Like, I was peanuts. You know, they were there when one of our cars got blew up. Like, in 2008, one of NPR's cars got blew up while the correspondent and producer and the other drivers were inside the restaurant. It was like parked outside the restaurant and it got blown up. So these guys had been through so much. So, I mean, they knew way more than I did about everything.
That's the thing I wanted to ask you about. Like, you did this incredible piece called Diary of a Bad Year, which we're going to talk about, that was about your sort of dilemma with being a war correspondent.
Right.
But did Ahmed have the same dilemma?
Course.
Like, was he conflicted or had he just become like hardened to his job?
No, he's not a hardened kind of guy. He's a he's the perfect combination of, you know, tough. He's a big dude and he's tough. And I mean, seriously, if you were in a fight with anyone, you would want Ahmed on your side. But very like soft-spoken and polite, which is really important when you're trying to like get through a checkpoint or go into a neighborhood where you don't belong or trying to sort of sweet talk your way past somebody who thinks you shouldn't be where you are. But also like not super cynical. I mean, he'd been working with us since he was like 21. I mean, it was in his entire adult life was like working with journalists in his city as it completely and totally fell apart.
Do fixers burn out?
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah, yeah. Ahmed wants to come to the U.S. Like Ahmed has thought about coming to the U.S. with his family. It's way more stressful on them because they have to like go home at night. We're like in this like, you know, walled off compound, kind of. I mean, it's like a house. It's a regular house, like where Iraqis used to live before they fled and then rented houses to members of the media for large sums of money. but it was kind of like a secure street. Like we had guards on the end of the, on either end of the block. And there were like guards and guard towers, armed guards and guard towers, like 24 hours a day. And so that was my life. But then at the end of the night, he went home. It was way harder for him. And, like, sat in 2 hours of traffic and, like, tried to get home before curfew and dealt with all the checkpoints and dealt with the fact that people harassed him because of what his sect was, if he wasn't in the right sector, in the wrong neighborhood, you know, and dealt with fear and threats and bribes and corruption and all kinds of crap that I just, like, sat in my house and, like, was, like, writing stories.
Do you think that fixers get enough credit?
No. Absolutely not. Not even close. I mean, we should name them in our stories. Like, every time I went out and did a story, I was like, I wanted to just, like, have, like, a list of credits.
It seems like it's a completely fascinating job that's almost completely in the shadows.
Yeah, I always think about that. And so in one of the, we're probably getting ahead of ourselves, but in one of the podcast episodes that I recently did, sort of one of our main characters is our local colleague. Sometimes you skirt the edge of like, I talked to my taxi driver and here's what he said, like that sort of old saw in journalism, and you really don't want to do that. You know, I mean, there's like so many ways to mock that approach. You know, it's this sense that like, oh, I talked to the guy who I paid and got his opinion and therefore I'm done with my story. Like, you don't want to do that, right? But you also want to acknowledge that these people are humans and that like this thing that you're crazy running around reporting on, you just saw like a deceased man's arm like fall out of the side of the bus. Like, you want to be like, whoa, dude, how does that affect you?
So you left in September 2013.
Yeah.
That piece you did, The Diary of a Bad Year, it's in the show notes. People can listen to it. It's so visceral. I mean, you are wrestling with whether or not this is a ethical thing to be doing with your life.
Yeah.
You have a daughter who at the time was four. Three and four. She was living in Beirut with your husband.
Yeah.
And this piece you did, the documentary, it's basically an hour of you talking to other war correspondents, people in the tribe.
Yeah.
And every interview, it just ends with you being like, should I quit?
What should I do? Tell me what to do with my life.
How present is that for you now?
It's not a dilemma now.
Well, you made your choice.
Yeah, and I just want to go back.
You want to go back?
Of course. I never really wanted to leave. Like, I did not want to leave. Like, I mean, it's a funny thing to look back on a piece like you do a piece like that, and it's so funny to look back on it a couple years later and know all the things that you know 2 years later.
What do you know now?
I mean, it's like, was it a dilemma? I mean, I don't honestly know if it was my own personal dilemma. I know that it was a dilemma for everyone around me. And so I was trying to, I think, to some degree, honor. I mean, I know that you can hear me on tape talking about like, oh, shit, like this is no joke. Like, for sure, there was a moment when the Syrian war turned into the Syrian war, when it was no longer an Arab Spring uprising. And it was like, OK, here we go. This is real. And like when the first journalist got killed, it was just like, holy crap. This is the real deal, for sure. I was definitely like, what have I gotten myself into? And you can hear it on tape. I'm with my kid in the stroller, and it's like, that's for reals. But like the later dilemma of like, should I stay or should I go? It was almost like it was other people's dilemma. And I was trying to honor that by like going through the steps and figuring out like, all right, I mean, people want me to leave. Should I leave? And it was the hardest thing. I did not want to leave. Even when I finished that documentary, I still didn't want to leave.
Yeah, well, it ends on somewhere between ambiguous and no, I don't want to go.
I did not want to go.
Why didn't you want to go?
I just wanted to keep telling those stories. I just was so committed to telling those stories. Like, how can you walk away from the people that you've met in Syria and just be like, oh, sorry. Don't want to tell that story anymore. I can't deal. I'm too overwhelmed. You know, and that just sounds, that just does not compute in my brain. Like, it does not make sense. That was really the thing.
Because it felt like you were, like, pulling some escape hatch that they didn't have?
Yeah. Of course. I got to leave. They didn't. I could just make up my mind one day to be like, you know, this war is just too much for me. Gotta go. How just utterly unfair.
Whether or not you left didn't make it more or less fair, right? Like, you could always leave.
Yeah, oh, no. And then, like, tied up in all this is, like, so much hubris, I know, I realize. Like, it's not, this isn't clean at all. It wasn't this sense that only I can tell your story. I mean, I think some journalists get that way. It's like, you need me. It's not that. It's just, like, I, in my head, partially, too, I wanted to know how the story ended.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a disruption of the narrative. And the narrative was, I am committed to the story. I'm committed to telling it. And just upping and walking away, just like that wasn't a good ending.
How did you decide to do that?
I don't honestly know. Like, I've gone back and been like, when was the day? Like, when was, because that's a question I would ask as a journalist. Like, when was the moment?
When was the moment?
I don't know the answer. Like, I have no idea. It almost felt like it's almost like the documentary was sort of like, it was a freight train and I couldn't stop it once the documentary came out. And once my mom heard it, you know, it was just like, well, I can't stay now after I said all that shit. Like, you know what I mean? Which in some ways I was like tricking myself into leaving by doing it. Like, I don't know.
Let me just try and parse what you're saying. You did that documentary sort of to, like, appease the people in your life.
Well, no. To, like, to honor their, like, their want, their desire, you know, their...
Right, to sort of, like, wrestle with the questions they were asking.
Nice, yes, well put.
You did some wrestling, and you were like, ah, totally, it's very difficult, I would like to stay. And then they heard it, and they were like, how could that possibly be where you landed?
Exactly, basically, yes.
And you were like, fine.
Yeah, that's kind of it, as I see it, 2.5 years later. Jay Allison would kill me, but he wouldn't kill me. He would laugh a lot. Because, you know, he was part of this, too. You know, I mean, he was the person I was talking to when I was making this documentary. I mean, it was our idea to make it together. Jay Allison, you know, god of radio, who produce this with me for transom.org. He and all his wonderful colleagues there in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, asked me all these questions that got me to kind of think about all that. I mean, I just didn't think about any of this stuff. I was just like, I'm in the life. That's it. I've got it, you know. And so when he started asking me the questions, then I realized, oh, yeah, other people in my life are asking these same questions. So, yeah, I did feel like I had to answer them.
And what was the toughest answer? I mean, if you ended up in a place that was, I know all this and I want to stay, what was the most compelling argument on the other side?
I mean, writing that letter, it was just like, well, Jesus Christ. You know, I mean, that thing is like...
Yeah, I mean, I was just listening to the letter.
I'm so sorry. It's really heavy.
It is very heavy. It made, like, it made me think, like, maybe I should never leave the house. Like, maybe I should just be by my kid's side in, like, a padded room.
Ugh, I know. This is the way I never think. Like, I don't think in what ifs. But it was something that somebody told me, that somebody had told him. Paul Wood from the BBC, like a renowned war correspondent, told me that he, you know, he's got five kids, I think. And he was told by, I think, a British MP who was an ex-soldier, that if you really want to do this work, if you're really serious about doing this work, and if you really want to be completely and totally honest about this work that you're doing and the dangers that you're, and the risks that you're taking, you need to sit down and you need to write your family a letter. You need to consider that day when you're not here. You owe it to them. And you owe it to yourself to, like, to be in that moment and really think about that. And so, yeah, I very grudgingly sat down and wrote the letter to my family.
Okay, I think we need to play the clip. Here is you reading this letter in your documentary Diary of a Bad Year.
Dearest Nathan and Loretta. Oh boy. If you are reading this, it means something terrible has happened. I write this with the full belief that I will be taking all the right precautions, but you never know. However deep your pain is, please understand that I was not cavalier, and that I loved you both as truly and thoughtfully as I could, all the way until the end and beyond. If I can leave you with anything, let it be a little advice. While it might not give you comfort now, let it someday inspire. All of us must meet our end someday. Don't let knowledge of that inevitable death bring you fear. Rather, look it in the face. Walk toward it at times if you have to. Because to live without fear is the only way to truly live. If my life means anything to you, let it be that. As the years go on, read this book and know that my love is an ongoing postscript to my life, that it endures. Know, Nathan, that you taught me as no one before what love truly is. And know, Loretta, that the day you came into the world was the happiest day of my life. Live on with the knowledge that you were loved, and that you will be loved again and again by this wide and wonderful world. Yours. Kelly/mom.
Okay. okay. So...
No laughing. I'm sorry. I just, after hearing that, it's like, that is, it's, I don't, whenever I play the documentary for, like, a listening event, I always walk out of the room. I won't listen to it. And my husband has never heard it. He's just like, well, I don't... The thing for which it was intended is not true. And so I am not going to listen to that. You know, we were talking once about burning it when we got back to the U.S. We were going to, like, go out to the beach and just, like, set it on fire.
Why didn't you?
I think I lost it. It's in a children's book somewhere. Yeah, I don't know where it is.
I am going to venture a guess that maybe you lost it on purpose.
No. I think we just, in the move, I think for a long time, like when I first got back, like I always knew where it was. And I just stopped thinking about it.
Help me understand, Kelly. You write that letter, you record it, and where you land is that you want to stay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, let's be clear. I was super conflicted. I didn't have any real good answers. My gut wanted to be there, but my head told me to go home. And I went home. Looking back now, 2.5 years later, I know that I really wish that I had stayed. And for pretty much the year after we got back, I just wanted to be back there.
So you regret it?
No, I don't. No. It's this weird combination of, like, I don't regret it at all because, like, awesome stuff's happened.
Yeah.
Majorly awesome stuff. But now I still want to go back at the same time.
Do you think you will?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, will I visit the Middle East? Yes, like, many times for the rest of my life. I love that place more than anything. The minute I can go to Yemen again, I will be there. Like, I'll go back to Baghdad to report probably one of these days. You know, if there comes a day when the Assad regime falls, I'll be the first person on a plane. Like, there's a lot of stuff, like, that I still want to know and see. And for sure, I'm totally go back.
But would you go back to the front lines?
To, like, live as a correspondent in the Middle East? I have no idea.
What did you take back with you from that place and that experience? How did the stakes of your life change? Mm-hmm. I've never been on the front lines of a war zone.
I didn't spend a whole lot of time on the front lines. The thing about Syria, right, was like, it was the war next door. I was living in Beirut. Like, my kid went to this, like, beautiful school on the Mediterranean Sea. You could, like, walk through the campus of the American University of Beirut, which is one of the most beautiful places, like, down this amazing hill with, like, flowering trees everywhere and just, like, gorgeous architecture, you know? And, like, every weekend we partied like it was 1999 in Beirut. I mean, it is one of the best places to possibly be in the Middle East. Let me be super clear. Like, our lives were amazing.
What were your lives like?
We had a blast. I hung around with all the other people who do the exact same job that I do, and we talked about it constantly, and we, you know, we went to the mountains and we went to the beach and, you know, we worked too hard and we played really hard. And our daughter had an amazing life. You know, she had just fun friends from all over the world. She went to this great international school. She was, like, learning Arabic when she was 3 years old. You know, yeah, no, our lives were incredible. But every once in a while, they weren't. You know, there would be a car bomb in Beirut and my husband would lose his mind. Trying to imagine, like, if that had happened anywhere near her school and I was off in Yemen somewhere and he couldn't get from one side of the city to the other. Like, that's real, you know, and that happened. But most of the time, it was great. I know all that stuff, but I guess maybe if you ask me what I bring back, like, I bring back those stories, like, wherever I go, whenever I talk to people, I'm always just like, the Middle East is not what you think it is. It is nothing close to what you think it is. It's like, just tell me what you think, and, like, it's not that. Like, it's, you know, it's, I always get asked questions about women, about our lifestyle. I'm just like, I wore a bikini more in the Middle East than I have ever anywhere else. Like, yeah, going to the beach in Beirut and, like, drinking Bloody Marys was, like, a very regular part of our lives.
Hey, I'm going to put things on hold for a second and tell you a little bit about Squarespace, which is making today's show possible. Squarespace is, it's the way to build a website.
I've been catching some flack in this office for procrastinating on the completion of a website. And let me tell you, if you're a procrastinator, an ass dragger, if you will, Squarespace could save your life. You could tell someone that you had already made a website and then just make it, like, on your phone on the way to meeting them with Squarespace.
When you start a self-help podcast, like, yeah, a spinoff, and it's called Ass Dragger,
yeah,
you should use Squarespace for that website.
Definitely. Well, it's great. It's great for, we did the Browns cast.
Yeah, you were supposed to build that website.
Yes, the
you
ass.
You dragged the ass.
The ass was passed through the mud, yes.
And then you built that website in, yeah, like, minutes, and it looked great thanks to Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com/longform. You can try it out for free, no credit card required. When you decide to sign up, put longform in the offer code box. You'll get 10% off. Thank you, Squarespace.
Here's Max back with Kelly McEvers.
Can I ask you quickly about your husband?
Yeah, sure.
He's a journalist and a writer, and I wonder how you guys as a couple navigated these choices.
Not easily. It was really tough. It was really, really hard. We're good, but it was a really tough go there for a while.
Did he resent you for it?
Did he resent me? Oh, no, I resented him. He doesn't resent me at all. I don't think I resented him for making me come home. Poor guy, which is just a terrible thing to do to somebody.
But he was ready to go.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, he's written about this a lot in his own book, but we'd lived in the Middle East for a couple of years, and right when I was about to move to Baghdad is when his father passed away in 2010. And so, you know, it was just a lot for him to deal with, and we had a one-year-old child.
Wow. I want to ask you one more question about the letter.
Sure.
Do you think that everyone should write that letter?
Oh, no. Like, no, no, and no. Like, that's why I would burn it now. Like, no. It's also on tape and, you know, it's all out there for the world. But no, like, seriously, we should not live our lives in fear. That's what I say in the letter. Like, do not, like, I just do not, like, adamantly believe that, like, we should not be preparing for the doomsday. We should just live.
I mean, yes. But maybe, like, writing a letter like that would help you do that.
Maybe it would help a certain kind of person.
Maybe I should just write the letter.
Just, maybe exactly. Maybe about. That's what you're trying to figure out.
If you've got some stuff to work through, Max, write the freaking letter. But not
letter.
Everyone has to.
Yeah. If you're sick, should you write the letter? If you're a fireman, should you write the letter? If you're a soldier, should you write the letter? Yeah. You know, if you do these things where it's likely, you know, maybe you should write the letter. But if it's just like in your life, I don't know. I mean, some people like to plan all that stuff, and it does make them feel better. I'm sure there are a lot of 30-year-olds who've already written a will, and that's good, and that's smart, and that's reasonable. That's not how I do.
Tell me about what it was like coming back, what it was like moving to Los Angeles.
On the face of it, my life in Beirut and my life in Los Angeles are pretty similar. You know, like, I work a ton. I always come home for dinner. If I'm in town, like, I come home for dinner. I make dinner, and we all sit down, and we eat a goddamn dinner together. So, like, day-to-day life feels mostly okay. And then every once in a while, still in my current job, I still am getting on planes and going places, whether it's in the U.S. to do stories for this podcast or, you know, I'm doing some stuff overseas, too. So that kind of reporting is still in my life, which is really cool. I'm also, like, hosting a daily news show, which is totally different. And so that's really weird. But, yeah, just being in Los Angeles, like, for sure. I mean, I think I was culture shocked being in Los Angeles, mainly because before I lived in the Middle East, I lived in New York. Like, I think my culture shock with L.A. is more like because I'm from the Midwest and I spend a lot of time on the East Coast. Like, L.A. is just L.A., man. It's like there's all kinds of stuff to deal with here, you know, that's like...
Everyone's in a good mood.
Yeah, it's mostly awesome. I mean, but that's hard because, like, you know, as I say in the piece, I think that, like, the oppressively blue sky. I mean, some days you're just like, really? Come on. Stop. Jesus, I'm in a really bad mood. Could you just rain? It's not okay. But I mean, talking about the weather is so cliche, but it's a thing. It's a real thing.
What about journalistically? What was it like? What has it been like to switch your focus from being a correspondent to looking at domestic stuff and becoming a host? You are hosting All Things Considered. What has that adjustment been like?
Yeah, that show. They still let me report, which is key. I think. I always say, like, you can't keep the animal in the cage for too long because I start to kind of shut down if I'm inside for too long. So there's that. That's kind of baked into the system, which is awesome because we have four hosts now. So it's awesome. So, like, we all get to go out and just, like, be in the world and all the different ways that we are in the world, which is so cool.
Was hosting something you wanted to do?
Yeah. Yeah, 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 totally. Yeah, yeah. I had done it as a fill-in a couple times, and I was like, wow. I think my favorite part of it is so corny, but it was just like, I have been on my own out there in the wherever for so long. For 10 years before I got on staff at NPR, I was a freelance foreign correspondent. Like, I was, like, literally on my own for forever. Like, I had no job, no benefits for so long. And I was just constantly, like, hustling my own stories and literally just, like, waiting, you know, in the void for somebody to write back and say they were going to take my story. And then finally I got hired on NPR, but I was still out in the world. You know, I didn't know any of these people who were, like, emailing me 20 times a day. Like, I knew none of them. And so when I got back, I was working at NPR West, which isn't headquarters, so there was a great, awesome group of people here, but I still, like, wasn't totally connected. And so, like, I would go to DC and I would do these shows and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, there's all these people and they're awesome and they're smart and, like, we all do it together and then we make a thing and it's 2 hours and it's fun and it's, like, so dynamic and there's just, like, so many things you can talk about in this tiny little space that just, I loved it. It was so fun. It's totally different from reporting because you're not in charge of the story anymore. Like, you're not the final sign-off. You're not the final voice. You are one in a chorus of many. And at first, like, a lot of reporters, like I did, I kind of hated that part of it, you know, just like, you want to own the whole thing, but you don't have really the time to do that. That's not how the setup is as a host. You're playing the role of the audience. You know, you're right. Asking the questions that the people who are sitting out there are thinking. And so in some ways, you don't want to own the story and be the smartest person in the room and know everything about it. You actually want to be the most curious person in the room who's like, wait a second, what about that? What is the reason for your study? Or, like, why did you choose Freddie Mercury? Like, all these, like, great questions that you get to ask. And it's just, like, it's a totally fun new set of muscles to use.
Exactly. That, yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to say. It feels like a completely different set of muscles, but it's also, like, as the host, you're sort of, like, skipping across the surface, yeah, like, touching a bunch of different stuff. But it's interesting because you said the thing that you miss or the reason that you didn't want to leave Syria was that you were so deep on this one story.
On this one thing, yeah. So I think that's probably helped the process a lot, too, is to understand, to really understand that there are lots of stories out there that are really important. And to also know that from the position of host, we can still give Syria its due.
Right.
We can call people up in Syria. I can talk to former ambassadors, generals. I feel like I'm doing the same interview over and over and over again about on ATC about, like, the red line. You know, Obama said he was going to bomb Assad when chemical weapons were used, and then he didn't. And I've just been super fascinated with that. So, you know, I can be like, hey, guys, let's call Chuck Hagel and see what he says about this. And they're like, okay, like, that's awesome. I can do that. Like, that's cool. You know, a question that I had in my head while I was reporting in Syria, like, is something that I can ask someone about in the studio and put on the radio.
Have you had to, like, modulate your style at all, for all things considered?
From a reporter voice to a host voice, yeah, there's a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wondered if, like, how fully your personality can come through when you're hosting a show that's listened to by however many millions of people.
I don't know. I try to have my personality. I don't know if I can suppress it, really. I mean, I try to be myself. Although I will say, this is something I said to someone when I started, and I always say it now, is, like, no one ever told me how hard it was going to be myself. There is something weird about getting in that chair and sitting down and, like, you sound not like yourself for reasons that are hard to quantify. But it's sort of like, I should be authoritative now. I should be somebody else. I should be an anchor. I should speak in important news tones, you know, like. And so you actually have to fight against that, I think. So you have to fight really hard to just stay yourself. And a lot of that's about the writing. A lot of that's just about, like, feeling confident and okay with doing live radio, you know? Like, when you're live, you're nervous and you get tight and it makes your voice sound different, you know? Your throat's kind of constricted and everything's up high in your chest. You got to breathe and you got to have good posture and all this stuff in order to just kind of sound like yourself. So I hope that I do. I don't know. I mean, I try.
Oh, wait, you have to have good posture? I'm, like, basically lying down right now.
Oh, that's good. When I am doing a live, like, it's so funny. I, like, scoot to the front of my chair, like, right before I'm going to do a thing, throw my shoulders back, get in, like, a nice yoga posture and, like, take a really deep breath. And it's awesome. It, like, I feel like things come out more clearly.
Do you think that confidence just comes with time, like with reps?
Totally, for sure. Just like doing a number of lives, you know, being, you know, when that light goes on, you're just like, I mean, the first few times it's just like, that's weird. And after a while, you're like, whatever.
Have you reached whatever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the first couple of times we had like big breaking news on the show where we had to go like back to back live for three, you know, because we do three feeds of the show. So it's 6 hours. So the first one was Paris. The second one was San Bernardino. And, you know, if you had told me right before, like, you're going to be live most of the night tonight, I would have been like, oh, my God. But then it's like, you've got to do it. Shut up. And you just do it. And you're like, oh, that wasn't that bad. And then it's also like, so what if you make a mistake? Like, you're a human being. Like, I actually think if we sound like human beings on the radio, human beings make mistakes. Human beings trip on their words or say, oh, wait, excuse me, hold on, let me try that again. And, you know, it's all fine. Like, and so I think just letting go of, like, thinking it all has to be super perfect actually helps, too.
Do you think that that's, like, a thing that's shifting culturally for NPR?
Yeah, for sure.
My experience of NPR is that not flubbing things was very important for a very long time.
Yeah, it's different now. I mean, do we like to blade the flubs out of the first feed for the second feed? Sure, why not? But like, we also are doing way more live segments now. And there's a real push and an emphasis on that because it just sounds brighter and it sounds more like life. Like, life is not a series of perfectly curated conversations, you know, where every word just drops perfectly and the music comes up at exactly the right beat. Like, that's just not how life is. Life is messy and spontaneous, and sometimes you laugh and snort, and sometimes like David Green's gonna sing some Barry Manilow on your radio, you know, like that's just gonna happen. Like, I think we all think too that like we should, when we're having conversations with people who know how to do it, we should do it live. And that sounds really nice. And we should spend sort of our resources on that really well-produced storytelling, like pieces, you know, like packages that you're really going to like put together and think about and produce. You know, we should free up our time to do those and then, you know, spend less time on those conversations that we can do live.
Do you think that shift is just a natural progression, or is that about something listeners are telling you, something like the market's telling you? Where does that come from?
That's a really good question, and I don't totally know. Like, I haven't really heard the bosses expound on this that much at NPR. I think it's just partly a style thing. I think we're trying to, yeah, I mean, I think there's just some bosses right now who are like, let's liven this up, you know?
Yeah.
It's obviously a thing. I just don't know. Like, I haven't, like, read the... I haven't seen like the edict on it. You know what I mean?
There hasn't been like the era of
the
flubbing
time, the
memo.
The era of live is upon us. Yeah, exactly. Flub away.
More flubbing. More flubbing.
More flubbing, please. I mean, my thing too is like, and when I was talking to bosses about what my life was going to be like, and it was going to be a world where I was doing a daily radio show and also a podcast, like I think that we all are thinking about podcasts and how people talk on podcasts and how... what kinds of talking people are responding to, right? There's, you know, as we all know, two kinds of podcasts. There's sort of like the talkie podcast and there's a storytelling podcast. And so we're all listening to that stuff and we're all thinking about, huh, well, if that's what people like in their earbuds, maybe we should talk that way too.
We never flub on this show. It's perfect.
No flubs.
Let's talk about that podcast.
Okay.
That is allowing you to not only just sit in a studio all the time.
Yeah.
Listening to Embedded and hearing you talk about sort of wishing you were back in the Middle East, listening to it now, it feels like you're scratching some itch. Like, it might not be all the time, 24 hours a day, but once every couple of weeks, you're basically just throwing yourself into some super intense situation.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Trying to navigate your way through it. It like was part of the genesis of the show that you wanted to keep that part of yourself alive, to keep those muscles in shape?
Yeah, totally. It's just what I do. Like, that is just the kind of story that I do. I definitely wanted to do it in the United States. I mean, people kept saying to me, like, just do that. Do that kind of reporting you're doing. Just do it in the U.S. Like, treat the U.S. like a foreign correspondent. Like, I don't know what that means. They're like, just drop in somewhere and just, I don't know, do that thing you do. Which wasn't super helpful, but... But yeah, I mean, what it is, that thing I do is just go to places that people don't necessarily want to go. and figure out what's going on. And then when I started to put all that together and think about it in terms of a podcast, I started to get really, really excited.
What does a podcast allow you to do that you can't do on the radio?
Longer stories, obviously, which is what every radio reporter wants to do, right? I wish I could do longer stories, which it's super cliche and sort of annoying because not all stories need to be long at all. There's a lot of stories that are really, really good short, a lot of conversations that are really, really good short. Marketplace, man, those guys are the masters at doing like so much in so little time. It's so cool. And nobody knows how hard that is. Like, that is the hardest thing to do, is to do it short. So, you know, you got to be careful. You can't be like, I can just do this story as long as I want. It's a podcast. You got to be we're super careful at Embedded. We like always checking ourselves like, this should be shorter, right? Yeah. We should shorten this. We're just trying not to make sure we're not indulging ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. Two, I wanted to play with the form. I wanted to get in the game. Everybody else that's awesome is doing it. I wanted to do it too. Like, it's a different kind of writing. It's a different kind of reporting. There's all this great, like, all these great chances to, like, be really transparent, which I'm fine with and like. But I also feel like you can check yourself a little better in podcasts.
What do you mean?
You know, you got to be a little more upfront about like how you got to a place or how you got to a person or how you got to a story or how you didn't get to something, how you failed at something, what you're thinking in a moment.
I mean, it's interesting to say that you say you have to, because I don't know that you have to. I mean, it feels to me like that's a big part of what you're doing is making sure the listener knows the process, because you're just parachuting into these places.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like, in a way, you don't necessarily need a fixer because you speak the language.
Right.
But in a way, it's sort of like exposing that process.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You don't have to. But one thing we know about what people like to listen to is they like authenticity, for lack of a better way to say that. They don't need you to be a hero. They don't need you to be like the person who knows it all. Like, I went to Indiana and here's what I found out. You know, like, it's like, they want you to be real, a real person, somebody who stumbles and fails sometimes. I think the more human you are, the more people can then relate to you. And the whole point is not so like, everybody likes me, but it's like, so people will want to take my hand and come along. So they feel like they trust me enough, you know, and that they like me enough to come down the road with me. And so to do that, I feel like you need to be honest and transparent about what that road's like.
You were saying that part of the reason you want to do the podcast is like, everyone's doing podcasts and
sure,
podcasts are real fun.
Yeah.
What do you think of this whole brouhaha? This is this big Slate article about NPR and podcasting.
Blah, blah, blah.
Alex Bloomberg and Adam Davidson, and everyone's all mad and calling NPR slow. What do you think? As the face of the new era of flubbing, what do you think?
Flub away. I think it's kind of silly. I think like setting up this opposition between like NPR and the rest of them is kind of silly. Like, NPR does news and you guys do podcasts, and that's silly because other podcasts do journalism too, and NPR does entertainment too. Like, we've been making shows forever. Like, if you look at iTunes, like, there's tons of NPR podcasts that are on there and that are pretty popular. And if you look at, like, obviously Serial and Gimlet and all these other guys and gals that are doing stuff, like, they're doing great journalism. So I just hate this whole like idea that there's like, we're in one camp and you're in the other. So that drives me crazy. I think that it is a totally valid question to ask, like, if NPR has a strategy and what its strategy is going forward in the future. I think it's totally important for people inside and outside the system to ask that, right? I love that we have all these like sort of like pop-up ombudsmen in the world being like, all right, articulate your strategy. Like, that's great. Like, as a journalist, I love that. Like, yes, ask more questions.
It's literally the first time in the history of the world that someone has said, I love having all these ombudsmen.
It might be. I love it. Seriously, though, like, it's better for everyone if there's people questioning us and what we do and what our strategy is. Do I know, like, do I have all the answers about what the strategy is? Nope. But I know what the strategy is on my particular project. And that was like, wow, that sounds like a pretty cool idea. Here's some time. here's some people to work with. Now we're going to get out of your way and let you try some things. And the thing we tried is feeling pretty awesome. So that's cool with me. Does NPR have like a grand strategy to save itself in the digital era in the next 20, 25 years? I do not know. I don't know. And I'm glad that people are asking the question.
Well, clearly they don't have the answer yet. And I don't think there's a media organization that
does.
No one's got that answer. But they put a serious investment behind this show that you're doing. It's hard for that organization to move fast enough to get these shows out in the world. That is a criticism that has come from the outside, which is a fair one.
Yeah.
Like it takes a long time to get these shows out in the world.
Yeah.
Do you feel any pressure as someone who has been put forward to try and see maybe kinda sorta what that answer could look like?
The answer of the future, you mean?
Yeah, like
I feel pressure because people ask me about it all the time, but I am so deep in the making of this mofo that like, and I'm not in DC. It's horrible some days, it's wonderful some days, like way far away in LA. So I'm not feeling internal pressure to be like, go be the face of NPR, save us. No.
What pressure do you feel?
Getting this goddamn podcast done every week. Oh my God, this thing is insane. It's so hard, so much work. It's just a lot of work, you know. And hosting a show. Like, I have two jobs. I feel an insane amount of pressure because I have two jobs. And I mean, I brought it on myself. Like, it was totally my plan, my design, my foolish, foolish design. Like, sure, I can do it all, no problem. So that's the pressure I feel right now. When the season is done and we can sort of all step back and look around, I'm going to be having some conversations with some people. Sure. What's the future of Embedded? What's the future of NPR? What's the future of podcasts? Sure. I will be asking those same questions.
All right. Well, once you figure out what the future of NPR is,
I'm going to call you back.
Come back
we'll
on the show.
Break it
we'll
on your show.
Epilogue. NPR has figured it all out.
P.S.
Because Kelly McEvers
future secured.
Figured it all out.
Yeah, right. I have no answers. Yeah. Talk like yourself. That's like my answer. NPR will be fine if we all just talk like ourselves.
How are you choosing these stories?
Early on, when we were first, you know, kind of like throwing down some pilots and figuring out what this was all about, it was just sort of like, oh, that thing happened. Let's go check that out. And then it was like, I think we should make this about the, you know, we should take something from the news. And so like for Indiana, for instance, like my husband was just like kept reading these headlines like on page 16 of the LA Times. Just like he's like, there is an HIV outbreak in Indiana. He's like, I don't know if you guys are covering this, but he's like that. I don't understand why that's happening. And I'm like, I don't either. What's that all about? And, you know, don't get me wrong. Like NPR, all things considered, covered the crap out of that story. Like we had officials from Indiana on, like we really went, you know, that we went after that story on the daily news. But it was still one of those stories that just like you've got this itch where you're just like, but wait, why? You know, where you just feel like there's still like the questions aren't answered. That's how I pick a story. Like that story that's just like, hang on. I still don't feel like I have the answer. I'm like such a narrative person. Like I need a story to answer my questions. Like I'll walk by the TV and I'll see a thing like in the newsroom and I'm just like, what is that? Why? Why is that happening? You know, and then maybe I can go to the internet and like read five things and be satisfied, but sometimes I can't. And that's the story we usually pick. And then some stories, it's like we're on one story and then it kind of unfolds and we're like, oh, huh, that thing is explaining that thing that we've heard in the news. Let's do that. You know, so it's just all like, does it fit this formula? Is it just like, does it help you understand a thing that passed you by in the news?
So as we're recording this, there have been four.
Yeah.
And two of them have been about gangs.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Biker gangs and El Salvadoran gangs. That's true. That's true. I got a thing about gangs. Yeah.
What's the thing about gangs?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I have a thing about gangs, but I mean, one of the first kind of big reporting assignments that I did was for the Chicago Tribune magazine.
1999.
That's right. And there's a pretty funny This American Life segment about this. From, I don't know, that year or the next year, because I was a very young reporter at the time. I had no idea what I was doing. And I was getting all this amazing access. Like, it was like Embedded It was like embedded reporting without knowing what the hell to do with all the material you got. That was basically that at the time. I was like 27. So I talked a lot to Ira Glass about this, and they kind of made fun of me, which I deserved, which was just like spending all this time in Chicago with female gang members and not really knowing how to write the story. And then eventually the Chicago Tribune assigned a veteran reporter to work with me. And we wrote like a cover story for the magazine. But that was my first taste of gangs.
That doesn't totally explain what you think about gangs is. I wonder whether the thing is about something you talk about in that documentary, which is about dopamine and adrenaline
going
and being somewhere dangerous and going and talking to the people you're not supposed to talk to and going to the place that you're not supposed to go.
Of course it is that. I'm not sold on the idea of adrenaline and the idea that there is an adrenaline addiction. I don't know if that's really true. The guy I talked to in my documentary talks about dopamine and just how some people are wired in different ways. He actually talked to a set of twins. One had higher levels of dopamine than the other, and the one who had lower levels like was a stay-at-home mom, and the one who had higher levels was like, I don't know, a firefighter or did a dangerous job, like jumped out of planes or something like that. I'm curious. I would love to spend a year like writing that book. Like, what is it about me that makes me this way? I'm dying to find the answer to that question, or like listen to an hour of Invisibilia about it. That would be amazing. I wish I had the time to do that, and I would, and maybe I will someday. But in lieu of any sort of scientific research, it's just how I've always been, you know? I mean, I grew up in a really small town, but like, you know, on a Friday night, I was more likely to be in a Camaro that was going way too fast, doing things that I wasn't supposed to be doing, than staying at home reading my library books. And so I just think it carried over into my work. I lived in Chicago. I was in my 20s, like four blocks away from where I lived at the time, was this like center of, you know, some of the most really intense gang activity in the city at the time. There were shootings, you know, just like a half a mile away from where we lived, all kinds of crazy stuff going on in our neighborhood. So I was close to it. It was something I was interested in. It was, again, it was one of those things. I was like, well, how does that work? You know, I'll go find out. And it's just the fact that when I ask that question of myself, like I don't have an inhibition to then go to take the next step. People are always like, well, aren't you scared? I'm like, no, that's the thing. You know, so yeah, am I wired that way? I would love to know the answer, but I just know that like, you know, I've always been like jumping out of trees and swings and stuff.
And this is just the adult version of that.
I guess, right. Yeah, like I actually found people who will pay me to do it. I don't know. Yeah.
What does your daughter think of what you do?
She's 6 years old. I mean, she doesn't think a whole lot about what I do. She knows I'm on the radio. She won't listen to the show.
Really?
Nope. Yeah, she has no interest. Like her dad, I'm like, Mom's on the radio. You want to listen? She's like, no.
I hear her all the time.
Unless there's people around. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's my mom. So unless there's like bragging rights involved, like she has no care. I don't know. I can't wait till she's older and I can tell her all about it and take her with me on things.
Do you hope that she's like jumping out of trees and driving too fast in Camaros?
Of course not. She has no business doing any of those things. No, of course. Yeah, no, she's going to be free to do whatever she wants. God help me. It's all going to come back and punish me, as my mother likes to remind me over and over again. She's like, you wait.
If you think it was nature, not nurture, do you think she's wired that way too?
She's pretty brave. She's pretty cool. She's amazing in the ocean. She loves to climb trees. She doesn't have anxiety. You know, she's just not a kid who's just like, I'm worried about that. Like, what? She doesn't understand the word worry, which I, you know, respect and encourage. So she's probably doomed.
She probably hasn't heard it very much.
Well, no, no, her father. No, we've got the full yin-yang balance going on at home. So there's ample worry on one side of the household. He's also hilarious and will do anything crazy. Like he and I hitchhike together and, you know, he like paddle surfs every day. So he's not the teetotaler that I make him out to be.
But he did convince you to come home.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Partly. I mean, he was part of it. He didn't tell me to. He would never do that. But he really wanted to come home.
What do you think he'd say if you said, I want to go back?
Oh, I say it all the time. He's just like, okay. The other, I mean, like, we're constant. Like, our plans for the future are always hilarious. It's like, wow, if I get this thing, we might actually stay in LA for like another few months. Okay, cool. That sounds great. And then the other day I was like, nah, I'm not going to do that thing. Let's go to like Mexico or something. So to live. So yeah, I mean, he's totally game.
So that thing, I mean, part of what I'm hearing you say is that jumping out of trees and driving in Camaros and going in to hang out with gangs and going to Beirut, like, it's not really falling off, right? Like, that was part of the guy's, the scientist in the documentary. His theory was like, you lose dopamine.
Oh, right. Yeah. I don't know what he was talking about. Yeah. No.
That hasn't been your experience.
No.
It's just
He says it's a bell curve, right? Yeah. I'm supposed to be hitting it now. I'm 45. Like, it should be over, but no. I mean, you know, I just don't have like the physical stamina I used to have. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that I just can't do anymore. Or I never could. It's not like I'm like this, like physical. I don't want to paint myself to be like, I'm not like super in shape or anything. But it's, you know, I just can't like stay up three nights in a row, like writing a story from gang territory or whatever.
But you still want to go?
Yeah, no, I just went to South Sudan in February with Jason Bobian. And we lived in a, this is one of the upcoming episodes. We lived in a Doctors Without Borders hospital inside a massive refugee camp in South Sudan. Like, we lived in tents for 6 days and kind of lived their life.
Well, I hope, I guess I don't need to hope. It sounds like you're just going to keep doing this. I was going to say, I hope you keep doing this, but I don't need to say that because you're just going to keep doing it.
You do not need to keep saying it. That's right. Nope. I got no choice.
I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me. This has been really fun.
Thanks for listening to Long Form. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Our intern this week is Courtney Harrell. Courtney also pitched in on last week's special episode, and we did not say her name at the end, and for that I feel great shame. Thank you, Courtney. Thanks also to our sponsors, MailChimp, Audible, and Squarespace. Thanks most of all to Kelly McEvers. Her show is called Embedded. You should listen to it if you are not already. We'll see you next week.